welcome to a special episode of The Peace Frequency. The Peace Frequency is a weekly podcast series brought to you by the USIP Global Campus that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The USIP Global Campus prepares individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. You can learn more about USIP's Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge, and throughout the month of November, the USIP Global Campus has been offering our course on conflict analysis. And today's podcast marks the final live event of the course, and I'm joined today on the show by the two main course instructors. So first off is, of course, Jeff Helsing. He has been my co-host on this podcast series throughout the run of this course. He is the Associate Vice President of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding here at USIP. So Jeff, it's great to have you here and to be co-hosting the show with you again today.
Great. Thank you, Darren. And I think this podcast will be as fun and as exciting and interesting as the previous three, which have been terrific.
We're also joined by Matt Levenger. Matt is Research Professor of International Affairs at George Washington University here in Washington, D.C. He is also Director of the National Security Studies Program at GW, an executive education program serving the U.S. Department of Defense and other federal agencies. He is also the director of GW's Master of International Policy and Practice program, which is a mid-career master's program. Those of you who have been enrolled in the course will, of course, recognize Matt from his training videos. So, Matt, it's great to have you joining us today in the studio.
Well, it's delightful to be here.
And as I said at the start of this podcast, that this is a special episode of the Peace Frequency. So what do we mean by special episode? Well, first of all, those of you joining us online will notice that you can see a live stream of us on video. So hello and welcome to our wonderful, beautiful studio here at USIP headquarters. And hopefully this will make it a little bit easier for you to imagine yourself pulling up a chair, joining us at this table for this conversation with your coffee, tea, what have you. Secondly, all of the questions that we have queued up to stimulate discussion and conversation during today's show have been generated and submitted by participants in the course. And these questions we'll ask of you, Jeff and Matt, to clarify some of the main points that you've tried to share throughout this course. And they may, in fact, shed light on some things that people feel may have been missing from this course. And so we look forward to those questions and the insights that may emerge. And I don't envy the position that you are in. These are some really challenging questions. So I look forward to that.
Good.
Thirdly, we have one of the participants in our course, Hode Sultan, who's going to share some of her own personal experiences doing a conflict analysis and using a conflict assessment framework. Hode is also a program officer here at USIP doing work in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And so we've learned so much so far over the 3.5 weeks of this course, and so it'll be nice to hear from someone who on the ground has been using some of these frameworks and doing this work. And then lastly, as always, we invite our participants from around the world who are listening and tuning in to chime in with some of their questions that emerge during the show and to provide their own responses and perspectives. And our on-air producer, Vanessa Francis, is going to be moderating those questions and those comments. So if you have something to share, you can let her know by clicking that raise hand button on your control panel, and then she can actually bring you into the conversation and we can hear you directly. Or if you don't have a microphone accessible, you can instant message your comment or question to her and she can read it for you on your behalf. So we have an exciting show. We're going to go till about 3:45. And so let's get started. Our first question comes from Susan, and she prefaces her question with some on-the-ground perspectives from her work in Mindanao in the Philippines. So Jeff and Matt, I'd like you to tackle this question first, and then I'd like to actually turn to Hode to share a little bit about her experience in conducting conflict analysis and see if her experience resonates with or connects at all with what Susan has been sharing. So Susan writes, in Mindanao, Southern Philippines, many local NGO folks privately tell me that the international organizations and donors fund conflict assessment studies that do not resonate with local NGO peacebuilding or human rights organizations and their knowledge. According to these people, foreign organizations also spend virtually no time with clan elders, local people, on-the-ground rebel leaders, or even local government unit leaders in conflict zones because of security concerns over their own safety. And so this is why experts, quote, don't know anything. They talk to educated people who lead NGOs based in major cities, and they also rely on their own Western knowledge base or the latest program for resolving conflict or doing peace building. These practices and the elicitation of fancy reports are expensive. She refers to peace building as an international business, and they ignore or exploit local knowledge of NGO leaders and experts, most of whom are not paid except in an ad hoc way, but who are interviewed by international experts. So Susan's question is, how do we deal with this gap in knowledge and practical application for conflict assessment and peace building between local and international NGOs? Who wants to tackle that first?
I think there's one sentence that would be an answer, and I'll expand on it a little bit, but it's really important to know what you don't know. And so there will be certainly times in which, for reason of resources, perhaps for reasons of security, that there won't be a thorough conflict analysis done of a particular place. You note that many of the different stakeholders or important actors may not have been interviewed, talked to, etc. And that's certainly a limitation of any good conflict analysis, and it dilutes the value of conflict analysis if it's all based upon a framework that comes from the outside and is, in a sense, been made to fit a particular place or particular set of circumstances. And so that's why I say it's if that is done with an assumption that then a thorough conflict analysis has been taken care of, that's going to be particularly a big waste of time and resources. So it's important to know what the limitations are and be mindful of that in doing so. Now, my sense is that the way one addresses that is to work with local partners. That is, no outside institution, no outside organization or individual could come into a society and somehow, as an outsider, be able to easily assess the situation. So use local resources, use and partner with those that can get to work with or provide a way for you to do so in a local context in a meaningful way.
Yeah, I would echo the point that it's critical to work with local partners. I think the question highlights a number of the shortcomings of many kinds of programs in conflict zones. There was mention of security concerns, which clearly are a limitation, but again, which close collaboration with a trusted local partner can help mitigate. For example, the U.S. Institute of Peace operates in a lot of rather dangerous conflict zones around the world and is generally able to operate without excessive risk to its staff by virtue of working closely with trusted local partners. But there's also reference to a kind of a loop of decision-making and program implementation, which ironically excludes the people who are most affected by and most interested in the success or failure of a given project. So there are the outside funders, there are the Western educated and connected experts, there are the national experts from perhaps civil society organizations in the national capital. But what seems to be very tenuous in this description of the program is the absence of any strong connection with the local communities. And so when we're delivering programs, we absolutely need to listen to the people who are being affected by the programs. And that may mean that more resources are invested up front in really involving the community in an extensive way and then assessing the results on an ongoing basis. But that effort spent on listening and planning and careful assessment of the consequences of programs is essential in order for whatever program you're doing to be successful.
I think one other thing I just add, and I think Susan and everyone else that's been taking this course, I hope one of the things that you come away with is a realization that there's no magic wand in any of this. There's no one framework that we're going to tout, we're going to advertise and say, oh, well, this particular framework, this is the one you really need to use. Because a framework is only as good as the process that one goes forward in utilizing that framework, in operationalizing the conflict analysis. And so, you know, absent a good operational plan or the implementation, I go back to the basic framework that we talked about, which is who, what, when, where, why, and how. So if, and again, a really good reporter or somebody who really understands how to get it down into meeting with and talking to local people, you know, you could just be with a small spiral notebook and good reporter questions, and you may be much more effective in understanding a particular conflict than somebody who has a you know, 5-page or 10-page framework that sort of guides you with all particular questions. But as Matt points out, if all you're doing is talking to what we oftentimes refer to as the usual suspects, are you really going to get a good sense of that conflict?
Yeah, I'd like to turn now to Hode to share a little bit about her experience, because we've talked a lot about some kind of principles or better practices, whatever you want to call them, and you've painted a picture of the journalist with the notebook asking these questions. And so, you know, does this picture and how do these principles actually translate on the ground and in the field? So at this point, I'd like to open up the line to Hode. Can we bring her in on the show?
Hode, your line is open if you'd like to go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, Hode. Good
hey,
to
Hode,
talk to you.
How are you?
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you for having me on. I think being in week 4 of the course, it's kind of a reflection period and reflecting on the work we're doing. I want to first echo everything that's been said so far, that working through local partners is really critical, especially in a lot of the conflict zones that we're engaged in. It is very, very difficult to go in there, and largely because of security, and to be able to do a thorough assessment. There's that aspect of it. But then I think, and I've mentioned this several times throughout the course, and I mention this to everyone we work with, is contextualizing the work that we do so that it's contextually relevant. I think for our work to have impact and to make a difference, it really needs to be demand driven. So often, and we hear this and there is truth to it, we sometimes take models which perhaps could have worked in another country, and Afghanistan is a classic example of this. We often think, well, Iraq went through a transition period, let's take XYZ model from Iraq and then apply it to Afghanistan, and it should work. But the realities are very, very different. There might be some similarities, but you really, really need to do a thorough analysis and get the information, the critical local contextualized information from the key stakeholders. And I know that USIP, as you mentioned earlier, we are not direct implementers. A lot of the work that we do in Afghanistan, and in Pakistan, we work through local partners. That helps us get into provinces that we could normally not get into because of security situation. But then it also ensures that the work we're doing is demand-driven and contextually relevant. So when you work through local civil society organizations, that's the first point. I think in terms of my experience doing conflict analysis in Afghanistan, a lot of what I've done is working through one of the local private universities in Afghanistan, where we've worked with both students as well as faculty members to teach them the field of peace building and conflict resolution is about. And a critical piece of that is conflict mapping or conflict analysis. The first time we did it, or the first time at least I went in and did it, was with a group of students. And it was very interesting as we were designing the agenda for a five-day training. A day and a half of it was focused on conflict analysis. And so we went in and we said, okay, so what do we want to focus on when we're going to introduce the concept of conflict analysis to them? We said, do we pick a local community conflict? Do we make a case study for them? Or do we just take the Afghan conflict? And when we say the Afghan conflict, you're talking about over 30 years of conflict. So there's a lot to digest there and map out. So we decided we would go in after the fall of the Taliban, post-2002 to present, and talk about the who are the key stakeholders, why, how, when, where. We went in and we said, this is great. We're going to get really good information from these students. Well, interestingly, as soon as we presented where we would be mapping the conflict from, we just got blank stares across the room from all the students. The reason behind this was a lot of them had left the country. A lot of the young students studied in Iran, studied in Pakistan, one of the Tajikistan, some of the other Stan countries, some actually went to Europe and came back to Afghanistan. And so what happened is, they weren't there during this time period, and they were not following the events in Afghanistan. And so they looked at us and they said, I'm not sure how much we can map for you. Can we please, if the purpose is for us to understand what conflict analysis and how you can use it as a tool to design an intervention strategy, then can we pick a community conflict we can all agree with and we all have a basic understanding of? And for us, it was certainly no problem. The point was to drive the concept home. We did. So the takeaway here, why I'm telling this story, is that so often we tend to think coming in from the outside, let's think big, let's think of the national conflict, how does it impact things, and how does it impact the intervention strategy, when really what really helped these students understand conflict analysis was picking a local conflict. Actually, even within the university, there was a conflict that happened about a year ago. They all understood it. They all understood who the key players were, why, how, when. And that's what they used. And it was a very, very useful exercise. Flash forward, we did it a couple of weeks ago again. And this time what we did is, again, made up a fictional case study for them. It was mirrored on a province in Afghanistan, and we put that forward to them, and it resonated with them. And we asked them, we said, if we looked at the broader conflict, even if we just focused on the recent Afghan elections, and looked at it nationally and internationally as far as who the key stakeholders were, do you think that would have been more effective for you? And even the faculty a year later agreed, no, for us to really understand conflict analysis, we really have to start at the community level and then work our way up. So to me, that was interesting. And it was eye-opening that if I'm going to be engaging with these university students, I really need to start my way from the bottom up. And then that helped inform me. I could take away some of their feedback and then say, okay, this makes sense. Now I can understand where the triggers of potential conflict might be on a broader level.
Great. Hoday, can you give our listeners a little bit of background in terms of the work that you're doing around the world that warrants teaching folks about conflict analysis? Just give us a background on what you're doing. Okay, well, we'll wait for her to come back online. There's something that she said, Jeff, about levels of analysis, starting at the community level and then working your way up to the national level. That resonates a fair amount with some of the things that you talked about actually this week in the course, and the importance of looking local and not spending all of your time looking at national issues. Is what she's saying resonate with you?
Yes, although what she's talking about is really kind of fostering a good sense of conflict analysis by starting with something that's familiar or something that people can really find out much more about the causes of a conflict because it's rooted in a particular community. So that's, and I think that's very valid for developing an ethos of doing conflict analysis. But I also, by talking about different levels of analysis, it's also meant to understand that a conflict that we may see at a national level may in fact be perceived differently at a local level or at a provincial level, and not in the same way at the national level. And so where you are in how you're, in the lens through which you're looking at a particular conflict, is going to have an impact on how that conflict is understood. And so that there may be different factors, there may be different priorities, there may be different narratives at work in different places, and those need to be understood. Because if all you do is look at the national level, you may miss some important situations or important drivers that may exist at a different level. And that's what I mean by really being mindful of different levels of analysis.
Let me just jump in here, because one thing that I took from the story is that not only is it useful for people to analyze something that's relevant to their own experience, but that as a conflict management professional, it's most useful to analyze a conflict at the level where you may be able to have an impact. So if Hode and her colleagues go in and say, let's analyze Afghan politics from 2002 to 2013, it's not necessarily that relevant to the type of work that the people they're training will ultimately be doing. And if instead you say, well, let's look at this conflict that happened in your university 6 months ago, not only is that intuitively easier to grasp, but the analytical process also matches up with the scale at which the graduates of this class might actually be working. And so that in that sense, what makes the conflict analysis meaningful is that it can somehow inform action, and that you get some sort of feedback loop that's going to be relevant to the work of a peace builder.
Now, Hode mentioned that she walked her students through a conflict analysis process and exercise. And Matt, in your office hours questions this week, actually, you address the question of how did you come about, or why did you feel it necessary for USIP to develop a kind of its own unique framework? And the point that you really tried to hammer home is that this is not intended to replace other frameworks that are out there, but as something that can kind of create a unified language and can actually be adapted to fit a variety of different structures, if I understood you correctly. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about how you feel the conflict assessment framework that you walked folks through in the course does that.
That is a really important tension, I think, within teaching conflict analysis. That on the one hand, it's important to have a set of analytical tools that we can use for this process. On the other hand, you don't want to make those tools so very complicated that they serve as a barrier to a common conversation. I described the USIP framework, which is developed in more detail in my book on conflict analysis, as a translation device that uses some pretty common principles, like the principle of dividers and connectors, the principle of actors, the principles of windows of risk and opportunity. These are concepts that are found in many different frameworks, often with slightly different terminology used to describe them. The thing that I think is, there are a couple of aspects of the USIP framework, though, that I think are noteworthy, although, again, far from unique. One is that we emphasize the importance of analyzing drivers of peace as well as drivers of conflict. Because there's a tendency in some conflict assessment processes to focus so much on the things that are creating conflict that when one comes out of this kind of exercise, one can sometimes feel overwhelmed because you say there's so many causes of conflict, how could we possibly have a productive impact here? They're really doomed to civil war or international war or what have you. And so when we analyze the drivers of peace, we almost always find that people have more difficulty coming up with connectors and drivers of peace than with dividers and drivers of conflict. And so it's a very, very important discipline for us to push ourselves to understand those things that hold societies together as well as those things that tear societies apart, because your work as a peace builder will inevitably focus on enhancing those drivers of peace. A second aspect of the USIP framework that is a little bit unusual and perhaps even controversial is that it doesn't focus on what are often described as things like root causes, structural causes, proximate causes. We don't use that term because conflict is a human phenomenon. And instead, by focusing on the interaction between the dividers, which are considered potential sources of division within a society, we emphasize how particular actors are using those dividers and how their followers are mobilizing around those dividers. And so that the causal relationship here really involves the dynamic by which individual actors are mobilizing their followers around particular dividers. And from my standpoint, that is a useful discipline as well, because one of the questions is, well, which are the most important causes of a conflict? Which root cause, which proximate cause should we be focusing on? And to understand which of those causes or which of those factors are the most germane, we need to understand how particular actors within particular communities are mobilizing around those dividers or conversely around those connectors.
And actually, a couple of our participants posed a question getting at sources, causes of conflict, which is interesting that you mentioned that the framework that you helped develop here at USIP doesn't delve too much into that, but focuses more on the human element, if I'm hearing you correctly. Yet in the course and in the virtual classroom, we have referred to sources of conflict or causes of conflict. So we have a question from Frida, and then Carla has a similar question. And Frida writes, during the course, sources of conflict and causes of conflict have both been used. Are these synonymous to one another, or are we talking about different aspects of conflict? I seem to remember from my previous studies at Uppsala that, quote, causes of war as a field of research is rather limited and seen as something that takes place after the end of a conflict and is not necessarily done with the aim of finding ways to end a particular conflict, but rather understand why war occurs in general. And then Carla follows up with a similar question, is that she'd like a clarification on the differences between these various causes, sources of conflict, and then figuring out which ones to prioritize when doing peace-building work. So let's go to the first question. Causes of conflict, sources of conflict, are they synonymous?
Jeff may answer this differently, but I personally wouldn't draw any particular significant distinction between causes of conflict and sources of conflict. Frida mentions the Uppsala project. There's another project which was called Correlates of War. And in some ways, I would be more comfortable with the term correlates of war rather than causes of war, again, because we can establish certain kinds of correlation between social and political factors and conflict. For example, we know that transitional societies, which are between the stage of autocracy and fully consolidated democracy, are far more likely to experience civil war than either full autocracies or full democracies. We know that countries with high infant mortality or countries with neighboring states at war, or countries that are economically isolated from the rest of the world, have higher rates of violence than comparable countries without those factors. But at the same time, there are some very poor countries, some countries with very low levels of human development that are not at war, and others that have chronic wars. And that comes down to this relationship between the political actors within a given society and whether they are mobilizing people around those potential sources of division in order to drive conflict. So that what we sometimes see as being causes of war, I would see more as being opportunities for making war, or occasions for conflict. And so I would be very, very reluctant to reduce the causes of war to simple features within a society, because it's not the static features within the society, but it's the dynamic relationship between political actors and those more long-lasting factors that results in war.
I'll take a sort of different perspective on this. And I think the first question, by referring to sort of causes of war in a more general sense, I think is correct in that we can try and understand in general the certain patterns that lead to war. There are certain factors that we can try and generalize from. Same thing with causes of peace, if you will, or what makes for more effective social, political, and economic change. I mean, there are ways in which, certainly in our field, we do generalize. And so that's where I think we can find causes, where we can talk about causes. Where I think sources is a way of sort of trying to tap into specific cases. And in where I will, I'm not sure I'm disagreeing with Matt, but I'm going to give more weight to trying to understand oftentimes the more determinate sources of conflict that are embedded or ingrained in the particular society or the particular state, because those are factors that have to be accounted for. And those are, I think, some of the structural issues. Those are some of the more immutable root sources or causes in a particular place that it's like trying to understand, if we talk about the human dynamics and the human action, which I think you rightly focus on, it's also important to understand the stage upon, or the scene, if you're thinking about the action of a play, the stage, the scene, the context in which that human interaction then takes place. And I think that is particularly important to understand if we're trying to see how to help shape what unfolds in that particular scene or stage. And that's why it is important, in some cases, we can think about how to change human behavior, But if you don't change the structural impediments, the inequities in relationships, if you don't address the legacies of the past, then our efforts to focus more narrowly on human interaction, I think, are not going to be sustainable.
Yeah, let me just jump in on that as well, because Jeff is absolutely right that in some sense that you don't have individual political leaders who say, oh, there are poor people in this community and I'm going to create conflict. There are intermediary factors. To go back to this stage example, if in Romeo and Juliet the Capulets and the Montagues were best friends, you wouldn't have had much of a drama when Romeo and Juliet elope. So the fact that you have this long-standing blood feud between two clans makes the drama possible. And likewise, there's been anthropological research in religiously divided communities in India, which compared several communities with mixed religious populations, several of which had religious riots and others which did not. And one of the factors that was very, very important was that in the communities that remained in peace, there were what are called cross-cutting bonds, where there are labor associations or civic associations or other kinds of institutions which cut across ethnic and religious lines, and those communities were better able to resist calls toward escalation. So although conflict is always a human decision, it's not an arbitrary human decision. It's rooted in longstanding patterns within the society.
And in fact, I think what you're talking about really reflects the importance of looking for opportunities for peace building, because I think that same study showed or makes the case for sort of joint problem solving, if you will, that an opportunity for communities or different groups in a community to forge bonds, not because they kind of understand each other better or they meet with each other, but they actually have to work together and develop patterns of cooperation dealing with a common problem. And I think that goes to the more operational part of what you're talking about in looking for opportunities for peace building, as well as trying to understand drivers of conflict.
You are listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge, and we are joined today by the two main instructors in the online course that we're offering, or have been offering this month, on conflict analysis, Jeff Helsing and Matt Levenger. I want to turn now to a question around triggers, which I think is the correct usage of the term, and it's around peace-building interventions, missions, operations, actually becoming triggers themselves. And we had a couple questions connected to this. First comes from Michael, and he writes, I have had experiences where collective segments of the host country's population finds itself at odds with an organization's mandate because of specific interventions the organization chose to address conflict. As a result, consent from these segments of the population is withdrawn. I have seen this phenomenon spread regionally to the extent that local citizens render an organization or a mission regionally ineffective in delivering on the aspirations of its own mandate. In fact, the photograph that is on the homepage of this course depicts the violent withdrawal of consent that he's referring to. He believes the photograph is taken in the northern region of Kosovo, and I believe he is correct. In some cases, the withdrawal of consent lingers on for months at a time. I am uncertain how conflict analysis is conducted by the organization in question, but I can only assume that there are 28-plus varying frameworks that lead to methods of intervention. My question is, how can an organization navigate its way to its default position, conflict management, after experiencing such a setback?
When you were reading the question, I wasn't thinking of Kosovo. I was thinking, oh, Haiti. there's lots of examples of that. The only thing I would say is that the idea of the overall kind of goal is conflict management, and that's the end product of conflict analysis. I would just say that's actually a very narrow understanding of conflict analysis, because most organizations, most institutions, or most engagements, if you will, from the outside, are not actually meant to do conflict management. They have there's a range of different reasons or programs for engagement that benefit from conflict analysis. What we're trying to do is say that whether you're engaged in trying to transform governance or bring development aid or humanitarian relief or public health, that if you are going to work in a conflict-affected society or a fragile state, it's important to understand the conflict dynamics in which that aid or that relief has to, or is, you're trying to provide it. Now, the point, I think, that is made is that, again, the engagement itself is a dynamic new factor that is going to set off certain consequences. And so one of the things that Matt does a great job of addressing in when he talks about this is the need for self-assessment and understanding of one's own goals and what one's trying to achieve programmatically, and thinking through the consequences of how you or how an organization is going to operationalize this.
I think that's all very insightful, that we're not speaking about conflict analysis as solely something that people who are engaged in peacekeeping or other conflict management operations do, but really we're looking at it as an element of what I would consider reflective practice. Reflective practice simply means you reflect on what you're going to do, you reflect on what you did, you reflect on what the consequences were. There's a lovely little cycle that I talk about in my book.
Hopefully you're doing that, you know, beforehand, and not just as a debrief as to why everything went wrong.
Exactly.
At the end.
Obviously, once things are broken, they're hard to fix.
Right.
They can sometimes be fixed, but you'd rather not make the mistakes in the first place. And I guess it's a 5-word summary of the cycle of reflective practice. What? What your actions? What do you do? So what? Learning from getting feedback, learning from that feedback, and then what next? And that is adaptation. Ideally, you're increasing the pace of your learning, and you're paying attention to what's actually happening when you're doing things. And it's very unlikely that your peacekeeping operation is going along just great, and then one morning those whose peace you are keeping wake up and say, no, we don't like these people anymore, we're kicking them out. The chances are there were some intermediary signs. But whether due to institutional mandates that were inflexible or people not really paying attention or any number of other factors, those signals don't get picked up on or they don't get taken seriously enough until there's been some kind of conflagration. And so ideally, what we're doing is we're just getting in the habit of listening, in the habit of processing what we're hearing, and then adjusting our actions accordingly on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, I like this kind of 5-word description of reflective practice. What, so what?
What next?
What next, right? I like that. And actually, what you said connects to a question that one of our participants, Carrie, wrote in. And she asked, can Matt expand more on the concept/importance of adaptive leadership in conflict analysis? I am particularly interested in both Matt and Jeff giving additional thoughts on self-reflective practice and leadership, as it seems too often the focus can be only on the macro structural analysis or on external other identity formation without consideration for how each individual person's unexamined perceptions and assumptions affect their work and program management and their mediation skills. So could either of you touch a little bit more on adaptive leadership? Why did you feel it was important to include that concept in this course on conflict analysis?
Because that's the whole point of doing conflict analysis. It's to learn, you know, to get a better sense of your environment so that you can act in a more responsive way to what's going on out there. I think that very often interventions by Western agencies, international organizations, international financial institutions, what have you, are more supply-driven than demand-driven. You know, you say, okay, well, there's low literacy in this country, let's go in, let's build schools. There's high infant mortality, let's go in and invest in public health. And in listening to the broadcast with Jeff and with Lisa Shirk last week, I was really struck by Jeff's example of how public health is, you know, generally a good thing. We know that countries with higher levels of public health are on average less susceptible to violence and civil war than countries with low levels of public health. But public health exists within a particular social context. And so whose public health are we promoting? And what kind, you know, are we spending money on hospitals to treat the heart attacks of government ministers? Or are we treating, infant mortality of people who are dying from communicable diseases in impoverished villages? That it makes a difference, which of those types of public health initiatives you're advancing. And so conflict analysis ideally will help us move from a supply-driven mode of development or peacekeeping interventions.
What
or
do you
whatever,
mean by supply-driven?
In that we do what we know how to do. Okay. You know, if you know how to dig wells, your organization goes out and digs wells. If you know how to build schools, your organization goes out and builds schools. As opposed to going into the local community and saying, well, what's perceived on the ground here as being the problem, and how can we provide the resources that people are looking for? And again, not just the resources that the mayor wants to give to his brother in order to build the school, but you know, through some true inclusive and thoughtful process that will help us really identify the needs of the local community and then figure out what is the appropriate role for external actors and what can people within the community do on their own. So I guess I'll stop there. I have some more thoughts on this question, but Jeff, what do you think?
Well, I think the way you frame adaptive leadership is great. I just want to talk about the supply-driven interventions that we so often see, and I think that's part of what we talked about last week in thinking about the Busan principles, the principles in which those that are affected, those that have the need, have a voice in or can have a real role and responsibility for the intervention, the engagement, the aid, the assistance, etc. Because I think there's a recognition that the supply has to meet the need. Demand, maybe let's move it away from the economic cycle and think about the needs, because that's really what I think is most expressed in the local context. And this is part of what we're saying with conflict analysis, is that if you do really good, relevant conflict analysis, in effect, any program, any institution should then be adaptable to match what they have, their capacity, or maybe develop new capacity, and that is one of the challenges in the international community, or new priorities that to match what the needs are. And I think that's, and there's another reason why I think this is important, and it goes back to the previous question about the consequences of providing assistance without being adaptable. It's not just not only being adaptable, but that the nature of assistance, intervention, third parties can no longer, maybe they never could, but at least in this day and age, they can no longer sort of hide behind good intentions and neutrality, because they become part of the story. They become part of and a new factor in what's happening in that place. To the extent that, you know, we have Red Cross workers or we have other aid workers who themselves are the victims of violence, they're becoming targeted because they become part of the conflict dynamic or the context themselves. And so that we can't think of external engagement is somehow both neutral and something that you sort of do by the book. And this is why the analytical process is so important. It's not the analytical process. It's not a particular analytical process. It is the need for analysis that will, as Matt said, lead to responsive or informed engagement that's going to really meet the needs of those in the affected communities.
And one other thing is that it's hard for organizations to adapt. It's hard for individuals to adapt. Mm-hmm. We see all the time, for example, that organizations will get grants in order to go out and carry out particular kinds of interventions, and they get on the ground and they find, well, perhaps this intervention is not the optimal thing for us to be doing right now, but we have a grant to do this and not something completely different, and our evaluation process requires us to do this thing, and we're counting the, you know, the number of these things that we're doing in a given area. So there are institutional factors, but then beyond that, I think just psychologically, it's very difficult for individuals and for organizations to acknowledge their own fallibility and to say, you know, we tried this, it didn't help, we have to do something else. That very basic discipline of recognizing your own fallibility and being willing to learn from it is all too rare, unfortunately. And so to the extent that we can really do a good self-assessment as we're moving into the process of designing an intervention, we may be able to develop a bit more honest, open willingness to question ourselves and to learn.
So we become, and we have become, risk-averse, and there's such a fear of failure that in fact, too often what happens is that, as you say, you really adhere to the script. In other words, you know, well, in our proposal to the donor, we said this is what we're going to do, and by God, this is what we're going to do. When in fact, it may be you have to come back and say, look, given the situation and given the particular needs at this point, we may be better off doing this where there's an opportunity, as opposed to sort of shoehorning something that, you know, was planned some time ago into a place that is very fluid. And the problem with the fear of failure is that we don't reward failure. Now, if you think about that, and if you think about, you know, some of the great inventions and the way in which science works, in fact, you build on failures. Failure is something to learn from, but we fear it so much that, oh, that didn't work, boy, don't ever do that again, rather than go back to the drawing board and think about, all right, this failed, but what did we learn from it, and how can we do this in a way that is really effective? Now, having said that, I have to acknowledge that in many cases, in what the context in which we're talking about, failure may have really catastrophic consequences. So it's hard to just say, you know, look, we have to think of this as a laboratory, and oh, well, that didn't work, gee, too bad. So I acknowledge that it's a really difficult line, but I think we have to, these are the kinds of things we have to put on the table if we're going to think about meaningful engagement.
And our producer, Vanessa, tells us we have a listener who'd like to chime in.
Yes, I have three questions. I'll give them to you guys one at a time. Loyal listener Jennifer Klesky said that it is great for Matt to address the discord between funder ideas and applicability. What is the best practice for getting on the ground and knowing what to do if the international intervention is no longer relevant, or the intentional intervention is no longer relevant, but something else is deliverable, maybe?
There's no universal answer because it depends partly on the donor's culture. I think if your organization lands on the ground and you say, oh, this intervention is no longer relevant, and you say, okay, we were going to build schools, but now instead we're going to dig wells. You know, you say, that doesn't seem particularly well thought out. You know, we're certainly not going to fund you to just do something entirely different without a clear justification. So I mean, I think, I guess what I would say is you have to have a clear sense of what your theory of change is. You know, what you're really trying to do and why you think this type of intervention will have a transformative effect. But then if you find that there's some other mechanism that's going to be more effective in mobilizing change around that key changeable thing, then I think you should be honest in going back to the donor and see if you can modify the proposal. But that said, as Jeff said, there's a lot of variation in how open the institutions that are providing resources for interventions are going to be. And so there's really no one clear answer to that problem.
And I think that segues very well into another question we got, which is, what are some key differences between conflict management and peace building? Or do you even see some differences?
The way I distinguished between conflict management and what I call conflict transformation, which I would see as being more akin to the more profound system of peace building, is that conflict management is principally oriented around conflict termination of violence, whether that be through mediation, negotiation, peacekeeping, peace enforcement, development assistance, where you're trying to prevent conflict from becoming violent. But conflict transformation, or really trying to build a durable peace, has to do with changing the underlying dynamics within a society. But all of these terms are rather fluid, and different practitioners define these terms in different ways. I wonder if Jeff has a different thought on that.
Well, I think conflict management, and this has changed a little bit, because I think we tend to use conflict management as something of an all-encompassing term in which you can go from, you know, conflict prevention, conflict resolution, conflict transformation, but as Matt said, really focused on sort of managing, that is, finding ways in which conflict can be addressed in nonviolent and even productive ways. And what peace building is sort of emerges from conflict transformation, but it really is how to, through addressing some of the causes, particularly some of the root causes of the conflict, that you need to go beyond just managing it, trying to keep people from being killed, trying to keep a lid on it. And so peace building is actually developing and addressing the needs that will allow people not just to not fight each other, but actually to live together in a way that's both productive and is in which they both benefit from. So some people have talked about, say, reconciliation, for example, as being an important process of getting people to see that they have a shared future and that they begin to develop the means to live together in that shared future. And I see that much more as peace building. It's longer term, it's more sustained, and it requires the development of really both new institutions, new processes in which people can live together in peace, as opposed to that they're finding ways of not fighting each other or not engaged in violence with each other.
The last question I have for you guys, I saved the best for last. It was posed pretty bluntly, so bear with me as I try to reframe it in a diplomatic way. The U.S. is seen as both a positive participant in conflicts abroad, but in many instances as a spoiler or a disruptor that can actually drive a conflict further. So what is the best approach when going into a country where you're kind of unsure of the footing that the U.S. is on in that case?
Oh, that could have been much more blunt. If you want to talk about, you know, the U.S. role.
And let me add a part to that question, because I think someone who submitted a question earlier touches on this. And actually, it was Frida again. And so going off of what Vanessa just shared, Frida wrote in, "I'm interested in the dilemma posed by international actors trying to push democratic reform and the impact it may have on security. Because democratic reform means changing power structures, it is hard to avoid that those in power and people favored by the current system feel threatened and may resort to different forms of contending measures. I would be interested to hear Matt and Jeff's thoughts on this. How do we make an assessment of whether democratic reform is feasible in a particular environment, at a particular time, at what costs are we willing to endure for democratic change?" So I think that might be one, maybe a little bit more specific example of the United States or any other foreign government that says, oh, we want to push for democratic reform, but as Frida lays out here, some other issues, second order effects, if you will, start to manifest themselves.
Well, and both these questions have to do with an external actor, whether that be the United States government or some other international intervener, coming in and saying, here's the agenda, here's what we're going to do, so people on the ground need to get in line with this project. I think the best answer to the question of how do you go into a situation where the U.S. government may itself be unpopular was given to me by Ambassador Robert Oakley, who had been the U.S. Special envoy to Somalia back in the early 1990s. And he said that if your country is not trusted, it's doubly important that you individually be seen as a trustworthy actor. And that means that you deliver, in his case, both on promises and threats, because he had the U.S. military working in close cooperation with him. But most conflict management practitioners do not have the capacity to call in airstrikes. But this notion of really being a trustworthy actor and somebody who does what he or she says he or she is going to do, if you make a promise, you deliver on that promise, I think is very, very important. Again, we come down to the issue of listening that is so central to conflict analysis. People react badly when they don't feel that they're being listened to and when they don't feel they're being respected. And so again, even if your broader organization, even if the U.S. government is not seen as being attentive to the needs of the people, you as an individual practitioner or your organization as an individual organization may increase its credibility by listening well to the people with whom you're working. But ultimately, we come back to the dilemma that practitioners face, that we're typically not the bosses of our organizations. We're typically working for larger organizations, and we may be tasked with carrying out policies that we are not entirely comfortable with, or we don't think are the right policies. And then you're coming down to a fundamental question of professional ethics. To what extent are the things you're doing consistent with your own values and with your own understanding of what the organization should be doing?
There's actually a follow-up question on that, because you referenced the work of Ambassador Oakley.
Oakley, yes.
And that he had the kind of U.S. military behind him. And not many people have that, but we had a question from Mark, and he asked, how can we improve the U.S. military's efforts in affecting the drivers and sources of conflict rather than engaging on the indicators of conflict? So, again, focusing efforts on adversarial attacks and being that the emphasis, as opposed to having them focus on drivers and sources. Do either of you have any ideas or suggestions on that?
Well, I think asking the any military that's trained to, in effect, in combat is, it's asking a lot for it to be the main instrument of addressing drivers of conflict. And I think to expect any military, whether it's the U.S. or anybody else, to be the solution to that, I think is tasking the wrong those that have the wrong capacity. It's not to say that the military can't, in a sense, do their jobs and what they do on the ground can be done with a better understanding of drivers of conflict, but they can't be the ones to resolve that. But I also think that in the previous question, one of the presumptions I think that is really important about sort of democratization and external intervention is that it's different to argue that democracy as an ideal or even as its practice is something to aspire for than actually how do you get there. And democracy, if it's going to work, if it's going to flourish, is going to have to grow from within a society, from the people themselves. Externally imposing democracy doesn't work, and in part that's because democracy, at the core of democracy as a political system, is managed conflict. And so that by imposing democracy, you're bringing drivers of conflict right to the fore into societies that have no means of or no tradition of thinking or operating democratically, which again is managing conflict. Because it's a conflict of ideas, a conflict of political parties, it's a conflict for power, but managed with a set of rules and in a nonviolent way. But it is and it's again, as Matt's getting to, sort of the will of the people, the expression of people's voices. You also have to include and bring into that a robust civil society, a rule of law. I mean, there's so many important conditions for that. And the notion that this can come from the outside, I think, is not only unrealistic, it's counterproductive, as we've seen. And so sort of think about intervening with a plan to transform a society, as opposed to coming in and trying to be helpful to address needs and to help build the capacity for people to own and address their own problems and find ways of cooperating and working together so that they can ultimately live together in a shared future. That has to be the overall goal. And that's, I think we have to sort of transform sort of how we think about external engagement.
And what that means, I think, is that ultimately we're we often get more mileage out of rather modest and incremental interventions that are very thoughtfully considered than we do out of big ticket items like, you know, spending, I don't know how many hundreds of millions of dollars the United Nations spent on the Democratic Republic of the Congo for their national elections in 2006, for example, or in, I think, then, you know, and in subsequent elections. But these are massive showpieces that involve lots of helicopters and, you know, armies of logisticians and so forth and so on, but then you get a not very good result to the elections, and so then the challenge is really to figure out how do we have the patience, how do we figure out where we can target our resources in a more maybe in a what would appear to be a less ambitious way, but in fact may have maybe a more profoundly transformative way.
I think those are two good comments to end the show on. You've been listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the USIP Global Campus, preparing individuals worldwide through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. You can learn more about our course offerings at usipglobalcampus.org. And today, our two guests have been the two main instructors in the course we've been offering throughout the month of November on conflict analysis, and that has been Jeff Helsing and Matt Levenger. Jeff is the Associate Vice President of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding here at USIP, and Matt Levenger is Research Professor of International Affairs at George Washington University here in Washington, D.C. He is also the director of the National Security Studies Program at GW, and he also directs GW's Master of International Policy and Practice Program. So to Jeff and Matt, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks, Darren.
Thank you, Darren.
And I've been your host, Darren Cambridge. Our producers are Leah Cullins, Vanessa Francis, and Peter Weinberger. Our sound engineers are Blake Mobley and Emily Mella. Our graphic designer is Manuel Leon. And we are going to take a hiatus during the month of December, as we are not offering a course, but we will return in the new year in January, where the USIP Global Campus will be offering a course called Community-Based Peacebuilding, Engaging Youth. Main instructor in that course is Director of Curriculum here in the Academy, Allison Malofsky. So we look forward to many of you joining us in that course and a great round of Peace Frequency shows that are related to that issue. Thank you very much, and we look forward to seeing you in the new year.